Today on the Nerd Outcast podcast, we talk about Captain Picard and the new adventures of the Enterprise crew as we discuss Star Trek: The Next Generation. Hello and welcome back. I'm your host, Chris Bastian, and we're going to talk about the Enterprise D and Captain Picard and her wonderful crew. This is my jam, guys. Just so everybody knows, this is the show I was raised on. This taught me the lessons about life, and one of my favorite acting teachers said, if you want to learn how to be a great actor, watch Star Trek: The Next Generation. And I think Captain Picard is great. Patrick Stewart's wonderful. He's one of my favorite actors. If you listen to the Christmas episode, you would know that. I'm going to stop talking, because I will just go on all day about Star Trek: Next Generation. But let's talk about my experts. People who I think may know more about this show than me. They don't. My first expert to my left is...
Hi, I'm DJ. I've been on the show before.
You have. I think you were on the Turtles podcast. Is that the last one we had you on?
Green Lantern.
Yeah, Green Lantern. Everybody loves that Green Lantern podcast.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, it was good times. So, DJ, real quick, what type of nerd are you?
I'm a wide variety nerd. I get into comics, sci-fi, fantasy, video games, so this is definitely in my wheelhouse.
Where are you as far as sci-fi versus fantasy? Are you more...
I lean more towards sci-fi.
Okay.
I enjoy the technology, kind of the future cast of our own lives into what could be, but, you know... I just like seeing stuff explode in space, too, so...
And where do you fall on the Star Wars, Star Trek debate?
They're two completely different universes. I sit right between them nicely and can look to my left and see one, and look to my right and see the other.
How very Captain Picard of you.
Yes.
So diplomatic. Excellent. Initial feelings on Next Generation, like, if you had to describe it in two or three words.
Probably the very first show I ever really watched in its entirety.
Okay. Cool.
More than three words, I know.
All right, no, that's fine. Hold on to that. We'll come back to that. My second expert is...
Matthew Amador. I've been here before, too.
Yay! Welcome back.
Thank you.
So, same questions to you, Matt. What type of nerd are you? I know you're a gamer.
I'm a gamer. I love comic books, movies, different movie genres. I'm actually a little bit of everything.
Okay.
I'm a non-committal nerd.
Or you just overcommit.
And I overcommit to everything. That's exactly
what it is. All right. That's a wonderful problem to have.
Overachiever.
Same question. Do you favor science fiction more than fantasy? Are they pretty equal to you? Or
I'm more of a sci-fi guy than a fantasy guy.
Okay.
I think so. I'm going to solidly say that. And in terms of like Star Wars, Star Trek,
mm-hmm. yep.
No question at all. I'm totally more of a Star Trek guy. I am, as you know, I'm very anti-Star Wars.
Yeah.
By choice.
Yeah, by choice.
Not by omission. There are people who haven't seen it, and they don't know anything about it.
Okay.
I've seen it, and I've made a choice. Wow.
Even the original trilogy?
Yes.
Oh. Empire Strikes Back?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Don't bring that up while it's cold outside.
No, let's not. We'll save that for the Star Wars podcast. Excellent. All right. Thank you so much for being here. My final expert today is...
Orion Cooling.
Welcome back, Orion.
Hi.
I'm so glad I got you in so quickly.
I'm excited.
Yeah. You welcome to the family.
It's good to be here. Among my fellow nerds.
So I've seen you swing swords around and lightsabers, primarily lightsabers. So where do you fall in the science fiction versus fantasy?
I am more of a sci-fi fan,
okay.
But my roots go with Ray Bradbury.
Ooh.
So to me, I follow the story and the narrative.
Okay.
And where that is, usually is where my loyalty lies. So, in the conversation, the question about Star Trek versus Star Wars, I'll go to where the story is being told at. I will jump off the Star Trek ship when we get to some of the later TNG movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm gone.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really strongly committed to the first three of the Star Wars franchise. It's all about me following who has the best story. So, I'm a traitor or a loyalist to the story.
All right.
So...
Another well-played diplomatic answer. I have all these Picards in here. Well, now I'm going to introduce my Janeway. My my outcast for this episode is...
Hi, my name is Andrew Kudla.
Hello, Andrew.
Hey, Chris.
How you doing?
I'm doing great.
So, let's spend some time with you.
Okay.
Because I was talking to someone about this podcast and bringing you on, and they had a very interesting point that I want to bring up to you.
Uh-oh.
So you're a nerd.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
Okay. So, like, what type of nerd are you? You were on the Buffy podcast.
I was on
Buffy
the Buffy, podcast. Yeah. I would say anything with wizards, wands, dragons.
Lord of the Rings?
Yes. That's the problem, is that, like, I get very intense into, like, some parts of the of mythologies, and others I'm just like, oh, yeah, I just haven't, like, I haven't read the Lord of the Rings books.
Ooh,
so you know what I mean?
Okay.
Right.
But, have you read The Hobbit?
Actually, I did halfway through, and then I just stopped reading it.
Did you do any tabletop gaming?
Ooh.
No.
Oh.
No, I wasn't a gamer at all.
Are you a video gamer?
No, so maybe I'm not that big of a nerd. Maybe I just like Harry Potter a lot. That's what it is! You found out my secret! I'm sorry.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. Just don't be a Slytherin.
So, I'll get you on the Harry Potter podcast.
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So what about Star Wars?
I've seen all the Star Wars movies. I really enjoyed the initial trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't too huge a fan of the second batch of them. But I also wasn't really raised on it. Like,
mm-hmm.
It wasn't something that I really identified with early on. Like, I wasn't passionate about sci-fi or anything like that until probably when I was around, like, 14 or 15, and then I was like, oh, I like this stuff. Why didn't someone give it to me when I was 8 or 9?
Do you like... You like Firefly, right?
Yes.
Doctor Who?
Yes.
Okay. So here was the question that someone mentioned to me that I want to pose to you.
Okay. About me?
I can apply it to you in this.
Do I know this person?
You do know this person.
Are they judging me?
We're always judging.
We're all
okay, okay.
This was a conversation about judging you.
Oh, okay, okay.
No,
okay,
so he brought up a point that Star Trek and Star Wars are kind of the gateway drugs for nerds. If you haven't hit one, you've probably hit the other, and that has launched you into other things. Typically, I mean, there's exceptions to the rule, but those are probably the two big ones, and maybe like Lord of the, you know,
right?
They're so ubiquitous that it's kind of
They're also mass produced. They're easy to touch.
Yeah.
You're not like they're like the same story, but like at different times.
No. One's a good story.
I'm kidding, guys. I know that much.
And you're obviously a television nerd.
Yeah.
Like, how did you miss Next Generation? How did you like? How did you? Yeah. What happened?
I didn't really miss it.
Okay.
This is Professor.
Were you watching the Sequest? Is that what?
No. I was never watching Sequest. Although I did have a crush on the
Jonathan Brandt.
Kid who
committed suicide.
Debatable,
actually.
I have a lot of crushes on people in TV shows who died early. Like Trini the Yellow Ranger in Power Rangers. Yeah.
Didn't one of those Power Rangers go on to do, like, kill someone?
Yeah.
He got sentenced to death, actually.
So, Star Trek.
Right,
Trek.
Why we're here.
Did you see Star Trek as a...
A little bit, yeah. My dad watched it. So I did the... So I guess I did the Next Generation. But again, I don't know that I really understood it at the time when he was watching it. And so I just kind of walked out, which I really regret, because now when I watch it, which I only do occasionally, like I'm not following it very much. I mean, I enjoy it, but I haven't sat down. What I prefer to do when I'm like really absorbing a show is see it from beginning to end. So it's one of those things that I'm like, I know that if I sat down and dedicated my life to this, I could easily get fired from my job.
Yeah.
So I haven't done that yet.
Good point.
Yeah. Okay. Man, you bring up a good point. Like, my dad watched this show. He watched the original series, and then when Next Generation came on, like, he fathered me into it. Well, did you all have a similar experience? Did you all catch this when it was originally airing?
Yeah.
With possibly a parent?
Not the parent thing. My dad was a cop.
Oh.
And so TNG was like not his cup of tea. It was not I think it wasn't dangerous enough, you know? I'm like, Dad, we watched Chips. Come on now. you know, and I think that we were raised largely without TV, and my dad was not a TV watcher. So my dad, if he's going to watch a TV show, it's going to be Cops, and then, you know, not the TV show Cops, but shows about cops, and or he's going to be hunting, right? So watching TV with my father was very rare, and we only watched TV, we kind of grew up religious, so we're allowed to watch TV once a week, but TNG was the thing that allowed us to bring it into twice a
week. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It was where the rules started to bend. And so there I am. I mean, it was like there's a real endearment to that, because all of a sudden we had more options because my parents started to enjoy, particularly my mother, the storyline of TNG. And so we got to have some extra options.
TNG was a rule bender for me too, because my bedtime was always 8 o'clock, but then Star Trek started airing at 9 o'clock where I lived, and they would be like, okay, you can stay up and watch Star Trek, but then you have to go to bed. And I was like, yay.
Yep.
DJ, Matt, what about you guys?
I didn't really have any parental push into it one way or the other. My mom was very much like a classic movies fan. My dad was, you know, liked a little bit of everything, but was primarily a sports fan. So this was just one of those things that I happened to kind of stumble into. And my parents kind of did their parental review and realized, you know, pretty good storytelling with a moral center that they could, you know, agree upon wouldn't damage me in some way. And it was my thing. That's it. I made some other friends when I moved school right around the time I was really getting into it that also happened to be into the show. So it just kind of was something that we, you know, clicked on, and it just went from there.
For me, my parents didn't really, they weren't Star Trek fans. I think they either just missed the boat or they didn't enjoy any camp factor that it may have had at the time. Mm. I started watching it because around 1991, after it had been around for a couple of years, it was in syndication. At 6 p.m., which is exactly when we had dinner. Mm. So I was, my mom raised me just herself. So it was just she and I, and, you know, the TV dinner or something like that. And we'd sit down and we'd just watch it together. It was just what we did as a family, which is odd because we're not like any, we don't have like any real nerd influences in my family. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't necessarily seen as that. Mm. But yeah, we just sat down every night, weekdays, and that would be on while we ate dinner.
Because
and
then, it's just good TV.
It was just good TV, yeah. Exactly. And then later on, after like about a year or two of that, of course it was still going. They were still making new episodes. So then I started watching newer ones when I could, when I didn't have homework that I had to do. And so by the time the series ended, I was actually watching it outside of syndication.
Okay. Cool. Well, for those in the listening audience who, surely you know this, Star Trek Next Generation ran for 178 episodes, 7 seasons, 1987 to 1994. Takes place roughly 70 to 80 years after the original series, and involves a new crew on the Starship Enterprise. I kind of want to throw a question out to my experts that I found very interesting, and I've known this for a while. Gene Roddenberry was the creator of the show. It was originally being pitched in the 70s as Star Trek Phase 2, but then when the movies developed, they kind of backed off on the show. And then probably, I think, around, what is this, 1987, the fourth movie, the movies were doing very, very well, and William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy commanded a very high price for television at that point. So they decided to create, essentially, a new cast, a bunch of unknowns, hence the idea of let's set it in the future with a new generation of the Enterprise crew. Gene Roddenberry's influence on the show was very negatively received. He made it a point, there was a decree from him that there should be no conflict among the characters.
Also, no open war.
No open war. And I pulled a quote that I want to read to all of you. This is specifically about the first few seasons of Star Trek. A typical episode relied on trite plot points, clumsy allegories, dry and stilted dialogue, and characterization that was taking too long to feel relaxed and natural. Another thing that I wanted to bring up was, under Gene Roddenberry's rule, which was probably about the first season, maybe the second season, they had a huge influx of writers. I think they said over the course of 2 years they had 23 writers just coming and going with disagreements between them and Gene Roddenberry. And it eventually reached a point, partially because of that, but also because of his declining health, that Gene Roddenberry was no longer showrunner, and I believe it switched over to Rick Berman as executive producer. And there was this story that the writers kind of kept pushing in a direction that Gene Roddenberry was not fond of, although it made for excellent storytelling and is probably the more popular of the seasons of Star Trek. And there is this bust of Gene Roddenberry in the writers' room that they would always have in there. And as they started kind of deviating from his decrees, they kind of put a blindfold over the bust's eyes, you know, so he wouldn't see what was going on. The show was critically received, especially the later seasons, those that were not under the influence of Gene Roddenberry. So I'm kind of curious, how do you all react to that? I mean, I like Next Generation. Season 1 and 2 are very weak for me. I would say the show hits its stride in Season 3, which is exactly where Gene Roddenberry kind of gets hands off with it. So how do you guys, what do you guys respond to that?
I think I just rewatched the entire series.
Wow, for the podcast?
Yes, about a day ago. I haven't slept. I just rewatched the entire season series in August to October. Mm-hmm. And I went back to, you know, the very first couple seasons. And, you know, the things that they say still did. The special effects aren't very good. But what makes it really important, I think, is what drew me to it is, one, is it did establish a moral compass and a moral code, right? Which is prevalent no matter what in problem they have along the way. The high-standing morals of the show, or dare I say, Gene Roddenberry says not morals because that involves religion, it's mm-hmm. ethics, right? The ethics of the show are established, you know, ethically where everyone stands. So it gave them a springboard later on when they would maybe stray from those ethics mm-hmm. to go, oh, it was a, you know, it was shocking to watch certain characters go away from their core, which Gene Roddenberry established, mm-hmm. right? So that was interesting. Also, to see the cast of actors, I think one thing you mentioned earlier in the introduction is the craft of acting is so applied in this mm-hmm. series. And some actors get much better with age, and some mm-hmm. get slightly worse. But you had these actors who were trapped in a very limited script, in a very limited story, just rise beyond what anybody could expect. And I think that if you're looking at the first seasons, what you get to see is that craft really bring out an excellence in the character work. And then you fall in love with the characters because of their ethics and because of the actor playing the character, and you're willing to go on to the rest of the seasons. So I think though they weren't maybe very as entertaining, you know, they definitely feel stilted, mm-hmm. It gave you like a grounding that would be important for the rest of it.
My other experts' opinions?
I think that's interesting that you say that. I think nowadays, I think people would be a little more unforgiving about having maybe 2 or 3 years to set groundwork.
Yeah.
That would actually let you springboard. But this is actually, I mean, I'm thinking about episodic TV at the time, mm-hmm. and I can't, off the top of my head, think of, I think this might be where stories really started to develop on network TV, where they'd actually say, hey, you know what, why don't we develop characters? And, oh, they have these twists and stuff like that. Because what was really going on in the mid-80s? You had your Knots Landing. That was the story-driven TV and stuff like that.
Does anybody know, like, contemporaries? Like, I feel Quantum Leap was on.
Yeah.
Battlestar was off.
Off, yeah.
What? Was there any other?
That was 90? Yeah. That was on during it.
Yeah.
So Star Trek didn't really have...
And then you get, while Star Trek's still going on, you get premiere of X-Files. And X-Files would definitely learn from the mistakes and the successes of Star Trek.
You would also get the subsequent spin-off series, and Babylon 5 started airing near the end of Next Generation. But I don't think Next Generation had a contemporary sci-fi to compete with.
Nothing in sci-fi. Because Sci-Fi Channel did not exist yet. Like, this is definitely a birthplace of modern pop sci-fi TV.
Mm. Well, and you got to keep in mind, too, that this was, you know, the second coming of a franchise that was wildly popular and sustained success for almost 20 years plus without being on TV other than in syndication. Mm-hmm. So there was no way that, you know, with Roddenberry attached, the fans out there of the original series mm-hmm. in the movies were going to let this thing fail. They were going to tune in come hell or high water because it's like, hey, this is our thing. We're going to fuel this. And I think that's what allowed them to finally get to the point where it's like, guys, we're going to probably start losing people unless we do something to really keep them, because our name has only taken us this far, and we need to go beyond that.
Especially because with the movies, at this point, wasn't the Whale movie coming out?
Seven?
Yeah.
Which was the highest grossing
but not
at the time. No, it was well received.
Was it well received?
It was because...
Maybe I just received it for me.
You might have received it well. Just because I opened it up to critical mass.
It also was easily accessible.
Yeah, it made it.
You could walk in on that. You could walk in off the street and have fun watching that film.
Yeah.
In that time period, you know, where it's similar to what they did in the most recent Star Trek reboot. They made it everybody want to watch it. You don't have to know the legacy of Star Trek to enjoy the first of the J.J. Abrams films. Uh-huh. You know,
you mentioned something I should also jump that I should address. They did not make it public knowledge that Gene Roddenberry had pulled from the show. They purposefully kept it hidden because they wanted to keep the fans on board.
But, I mean, fans aren't dumb either. They could tell that there was a shift behind the scenes.
Right.
Whether it was by, you know, specific name or whether it was just by the way things were being done, I think and again, I don't have the numbers in front of me to do this, but I think if you were to go back and look at ratings information, I'm sure season three, it took off in a way that seasons one and two, the original series, never had.
Yeah.
I wonder, to put in a kind of modern comparison, and also something that you might be able to tie in too, is just play with me for a minute. What if 10 years from now, they do Buffy, the Next Generation, right? And it's a you know, respawn. It's 20, it's Buffy's granddaughter. You know what I'm saying? Maybe that's happening. But you would need Joss Whedon on that for the first season or two to anchor it for the old fans before he could drop out and they could carry it on its own legs. You know, you wouldn't. No one's gonna. If without Joss Whedon, no one's gonna touch that. You know, no old school fans are gonna jump out there. They're gonna watch the first four episodes because you're gonna watch a hot chick fight vampires.
Well, and I think it's very comparable, you know, to what's happened in the TV show Supernatural, which is, you know, Eric Kripke was like, okay, I want it to end here. Well, the ratings are really good. We want to keep going. We're gonna keep you attached, but we can call you showrunner. But really, you're just earning royalties. And
you're an
we're
associate
gonna
producer.
Yeah. And it's continued on, and you know, some people love it more, some people don't. But you know, the concepts were already built, so you've got that platform to launch from.
The one thing I would point out with these two examples is I feel Eric Kripke and Joss Whedon are very good writers, and I don't think Gene Roddenberry is a bad writer. Specifically with Next Generation, he felt that with the original series, he had character conflict between Spock and McCoy and Kirk. There was a texture between them, and I feel he did not want to repeat that. Hence why he felt everyone should not. And it's, you know, 70 years later, we're all getting along now. You know, all of our conflicts should be from these other unknown things or whatnot, not amongst the crew. It feels like he chose a writing choice that was not appropriate for the 80s. Like, television was changing. His show was about to change things, and I don't think he realized it. I don't know. Or I will say this. This was the second time Gene Roddenberry had been pulled from his own creation. After the motion picture, he was pulled and not given much to do with Wrath of Khan or the subsequent films. Ironically, those are mostly well received. And so for this to happen to him on his next show, I feel bad for the guy.
Yeah, I was just talking about this on the way over with my fiance that don't you wish George Lucas would have been pulled? Don't you wish somebody would have said, hey, stop.
Edit.
You are crushing your own work, you know? And I think that perhaps this conflict is what we need in art. We need someone to give us restraints. Without restraints, we produce bad art. That's just all there is to it. We don't. You look at Tim Burton's earlier films, whether you're a fan of him or not, he established a genre within the confines of budget, within the confines of studios breathing down his back. He had to make something happen. Now, with unlimited budget, everything he does is... it's pretty monstrous. You know, you look at someone like Ridley Scott in a similar situation before, when he had to make do with what he had. He created beautiful stories. I'm not denying that some films still work for him, but largely this unedited monster movies
we're
losing the ability to tell a story.
That's interesting. We spent a little longer than I meant to on Gene Roddenberry, but is there anything you guys want to say? I kind of want to move on to the next thing, but
I just think, you know, you have to give the guy credit because he was the granddaddy of, you know, science fiction TV, making it into, you know, mass culture and references that go well beyond what you would, you know, people recognize it regardless of whether you know Star Trek or not. But that being said, I don't think you can fault a guy who was there, who kind of, you know, birthed this thing and wanted to see it through, but... like any other creative process, sometimes it goes beyond you, and you have to know when to give it up.
I mean, he obviously has passed away, but the good side of his legacy lives on. The good side of his legacy lives on.
I don't think there's a well of resentment built up against Gene Roddenberry.
No.
You know what I'm saying? There's certain people who've come and gone. I just mentioned George Lucas, who people are like, oh, but you're not going to find a movie on Netflix called The People versus Gene Roddenberry. You know what I'm saying?
That's like, totally
true. Yeah, true. Well, Gene Roddenberry had a very optimistic view of the future, which is one thing we talked about on the original series podcast, which is what I really like about Star Trek, is it's not this dystopian world. Like, you know, it's Space America doing great things.
Yeah. Well, and I think we'd have a very different view of him, too, if they had gone with one of their original plans, which was to recast the original show and do it. But because they took this to literally a next generation, he didn't go back and just trash on everything he'd already done early on in his career. So this was something new. So yeah, you can't really fault the guy.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the Next Generation. Andrew, do you have any questions so far or comments?
Well, the one thing you guys have talked a lot about is kind of the reception early on, but and how great all the acting was and all that. But all those actors stayed on for at least those first couple of seasons, right? Like the main cast.
Except for Gates McFadden, Duncan Crusher.
And Tasha Yar.
That's fine.
Mud puddle.
I'm seriously prepared to talk about both those ladies.
Great.
passionately.
So let's talk about the crew specifically. And let's start at the top, because every Star Trek show is made or broken by its captain. Captain Picard, played by the wonderful Patrick Stewart.
Yes.
Sir Patrick Stewart.
Not at the time.
He was right.
But he is now Sir Patrick. If he's listening to this podcast, I'd be so happy.
Oh my gosh. I would tap dance with glee.
I know.
I bet he'd be on a couch with Ian McKellen with hot chocolate.
Probably.
Yeah.
Wearing a lobster costume.
One of the many things that make Patrick Stewart so cool is that he is so down to earth. He's very easy to approach. I'm not going to be surprised if he's listening to this podcast. So just right now, Patrick, sir, we love you.
He was not the original choice. The producers wanted someone younger, someone more, you know, adventurous, bolder, almost Kirk, William Shatner-esque. Yep. And I forget who, but someone saw Patrick Stewart in a play in, like, Buffalo, New York, I think, and they asked him to come out to L.A. and audition, and he had no interest in Hollywood.
They wanted him for the character of Data originally.
Whoa. Oh, man.
Because they thought he could play the, you know, unemotional and pull off the android thing. And I know we haven't gotten to that character yet, but they thought he could be someone else, and he wound up being this, like, super fan-loved, you know, captain that just really set the tone for the entire series.
In the interviews, he says that he thought he bombed it, too. He thought that he had his bag. He never unpacked his bag. He's like, at any minute now, they're going to kick me off this set. Like, yeah. I'm going home. You know, I'm like, oh, what an amazing thing to think about that. This guy who becomes kind of a legend, and this is definitely his springboard too. Mm-hmm. The American audiences would come to know him through this show. To think that there he is, just like in the rest of us who've done theater, like, this could be a 2-week gig, and I might as well just enjoy it while I can, you know? So.
Well, he also showed up on set very stern, taking it very seriously, and there's been many interviews where he said that Star Trek The Next Generation taught him to have joy with acting and shows, and like not to take it too seriously, you know, and to have fun and laugh at yourself, which I think is just so funny. But yeah, what do you guys want to say about Patrick Stewart? I think the choice is great. I think it's great to go against Picard or Kirk. Don't repeat Kirk. Do someone different.
Well, you've got Riker.
You've got Riker.
Yeah.
So
when I actually first saw the show, when I was first watching it, I was expecting Riker to be the Kirk, the Kirk archetype, just because, I mean, he's a handsome dude. Yeah. I'm like, oh, well, the handsome dude's going to lead and, like, you know, have sex with a black girl and make out with her on TV.
Yeah.
But
which we can expect that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Patrick Stewart is one of the, of course, best things that ever happened to the world. I think that the only time I've ever seen a commander come close to, like, hitting, like, how awesome I think he is in the new Battlestar Galactica. It was the first time I've ever seen anyone become even remotely close to how cool
Edward James Olmos.
Yeah, I just, like, this, he's untouchable. And he's untouchable because he is such a bizarre choice. First thing, the guy's name is French, right?
Yeah.
He's clearly a Brit, and they had to write around that.
Jean-Luc.
He has, if you look at the resumes, I mean, infinitely more training than the rest of the actors on that show. Mm-hmm. And he also brought, like, a Horatio Hornblower presence to a very American-styled show. You know, he's a very much a British, you know, admiralty from the Napoleonic Wars, you know, but also a lover of peace. You know,
He's an explorer.
He's Shackleton.
I couldn't have recognized this at the time that the show was on, but since then, I've been in the military, and he's as close to an authentic military commander as I've ever seen on TV, in the sense that he's well-read, he's well-educated, has interests completely outside of what he's doing that he still pursues, but yet finds a way to kind of work them in. You know, he has that kind of clinical demeanor when he needs to, yet isn't afraid to, you know, be down on the troop level, if you will. I mean, it just pulled it off brilliantly.
I agree. I think that's exactly what sets him apart and makes him amazing. I think I don't want to compare him to the other captains necessarily because they're all different.
Yeah.
Although I don't know if anyone does anyone like Sisko?
I like Sisko.
Yeah. Sisko was okay.
That is
okay.
Like
yeah. Okay. I mean, Picard's my favorite.
Picard's just
like
fantastic.
Sisko.
He's just fantastic.
But you really have to, like, if you're going to talk captain shop, you have to remove Picard and then talk about.
And
captains.
Then talk about okay. Yeah. Yeah. Because he's just totally, just heads above everybody else. It's just it's part of yeah exactly because he's not just that brute commander. He's not he's well read. He enjoys art. He is stern, and he's not weak in any way. He's just there's just this well of strength that's inside of him.
He's also accidentally sexy as hell.
Right? Accidental?
Yeah. People start watching the show, and they're like, "There he is. He's great." But as he developed more charisma, as people found more love for him, people were like, "Oh, you know, I'd be interested in making out with him." And they start giving make out episodes where he got to kiss like this super hot chick. You know, mm-hmm. And his archaeology. What's her name?
The archaeology girl. That
yeah,
he's
Irene
Vosh,
Adler.
Vosh.
Oh, my lord in heaven, they have great chemistry, yeah. Right?
I wish he was on Mars.
And if you really break it down, I mean, he's just really just an old white bald guy.
Yeah.
That's really it. So, like, on paper, he doesn't seem like it.
Right.
But, like, I remember actually reading, because he actually is balding, so he shaved his head.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading an article with him one time when he was like, oh, all these, I could do a terrible accent
Patrick,
of his.
Try it.
I was like, oh, all these people today are shaving their heads and I'm bald to begin with. I'm like, don't do it. Oh, so anyway, he hates it.
That's all right.
Yeah, that was
but
that was,
thank you. There's a little bit Patrick Stewart from that, a little bit Patrick Stewart from Jeffrey, a little just Patrick Stewart when he lampoons Patrick Stewart.
Way to drop Jeffrey.
That dude is awesome.
Yeah. Were you about to say something, DJ? For my experts, who do you want in charge of your ship? Picard or Captain, or Kirk? Who is
are you kidding me? Am I owning this ship? Is this like...
Let's say you're on a ship. Who is your captain?
Oh,
is it Picard or Kirk?
Picard.
Any day of the week. I want to uppercut Kirk.
It depends. Do I get to go on leave with Kirk? Because he seems like he's in way more. But no, Picard would be the guy I want to actually be my military commander.
Captain.
Kirk is the guy I just want to go to shore leave and drink with him.
You're right.
He's a drinking buddy. He's not necessarily like he's not who I would choose as captain material.
By the end of the run of TNG, Picard had done everything Kirk had done and done it better. Like, there's nothing that Kirk did that Picard didn't. Hand-to-hand combat, got it. Macking with the chicks, got it. He could actually out-drink. There's episodes where you show him drinking copious amounts, got it. And then still have refined elegance that Kirk never could achieve. I just think he just runs laps around him.
For my friend over here who used to be in the military, TJ, how do you feel about I feel Next Generation does a much better job about presenting the Federation as a society or as a military group than original series did. How do you feel is the texture of the Navy or whatever you wish to call it?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely incorporated a very stronger sense of there being a militaristic, even if it was a designed to be a peacekeeping force.
Mm-hmm.
But on the flip side, what was interesting about the Next Generation as a concept was, you know, the original series seemed like everyone's in uniform, and even though we're explorers, we still have this rank and file system. Next Generation was very much like, we're totally explorers, and while we have rank and, you know, commanders and whatever, they also have their family on board, which I thought brought a really interesting dynamic to the show.
That's a really good point. Did Kirk's adventures, they didn't have their families on board, did they? On the original Enterprise.
I can't remember them having the family
on board. I don't think they did.
Not that they ever really specifically addressed.
Yeah.
They could have.
They addressed it in Next Generation, though. They definitely.
There's schools, you see the kids
children,
at play,
yeah.
There's children touring the starship all the time.
There was numerous occasions where they'd get into a battle and they'd separate the ship in a cool way that was done. That, hey, move the civilians off, let's get on the battle bridge and go do the real fighting.
That was so cool.
Yeah.
And also the fact that the saucer section was totally the most... It makes sense again in the whole aerospace dynamic fighting. That's what you want to fight with. It can go any direction it needs to go in. It's fantastic. But they did not leave the other main section undefended. Also had some serious heat on that thing too. So it wasn't like, let's leave all the... Take the guns! Let's go! Leave the civilians behind! It was just like... I like the fact that the main ship that they left behind still could, like, pack a major wallop. Some of the bigger guns were on that ship.
Were you aware of this, by the way, that the saucer could separate?
No!
It's the coolest thing!
The Enterprise D, as it is known, that can split in half. You're familiar with Patrick Stewart.
Yes. Okay. I know, I've seen that much. I know it. I know the characters that you're mentioning. Mm-hmm. I couldn't remember Cisco's name, and then when you said it, I was like, is that where that singer got that name from? that's where my head went, so I spent bit of time on that. Just a little bit.
That's awesome. If Bajorans were singing the thong song, I may have liked that right. spin off a lot more.
I want to see that.
I never saw that happen.
They
in
don't
the
do
show.
It very often.
I can think of three times off the top of
and
my
they
head.
Do it,
that's about it.
And I think one of them's in the movie. The ship can separate.
Now this is I do have a question about the story itself as opposed to some of the other spin-offs of the Star Trek universe. Okay. Specifically, Voyager was the one that was like, oh, we went into this black hole and now we're
Voyagers were on the whole another side.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. So where like what was the main agenda of the of Picard's
to seek out new life and new civilizations?
Yeah, they
to boldly go.
Yes,
but that's
no
where
one.
It all.
We're
that's
no
where
one.
All it is.
I mean, well, before. I mean, like
that's the difference between that and Kirk. Because Kirk was where no man had gone before.
No,
so we were more egalitarian 80 years after Kirk.
Okay. Yeah,
so no one had gone before.
There was no consistent plot line. Mm-hmm. Like they would bring back villains and certain plot threads, but unlike say like Battlestar Galactica or Deep Space Nine, there was not an overarching plot thread.
And it wasn't like that they were disconnected from their home, right?
No,
like,
they were. They're the flagship of the Federation, so they're everywhere.
Well, they go back to Starfleet, and they hang out, get some coffee.
Cool. Yeah, and there's all kinds of different like space bases, and there's like and they have a thing called subspace communications. They always get letters and commands and whatnot back and forth.
Yeah,
so they're very much in touch with the world. And of course, that's the fun. There's a great story dynamic when they're outside of that, when they can all communicate with Starfleet and what's going on there. They can build some great tension that way. When the umbilical cord is separated, so
let's keep moving on with the cast list. Moving on to. Commander.
Just Picard.
Yeah, there was talking to
We only talked about Picard. I don't know if we're going to hit the whole freaking
Let's just really quickly talk about these people.
So, his number one, his second in command, Commander William Riker, Jonathan, played by Jonathan Frakes, who I have seen interviews and admits, he's like, I feel I'm not a very good actor. And he said he felt acting against Patrick Stewart was like playing tennis with someone who is a grandmaster at tennis. And he felt like Patrick Stewart elevated all of them as actors. It's like he walks on set and just commands this presence and this focus with how to do this craft. And they all felt like they had to get their shit together. At the same time, they're like telling him, hey, we're having fun. We're having a good time.
I could see that. Totally. He's turned into a very capable TV director.
He has. Yeah.
Yes.
This is the bearded guy, right?
The bearded
guy.
Yes. He is supposed to be
He did
Kirk.
Have a beard for season 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Season 3 had a beard.
Then he grew it.
Yeah. He was supposed, since Picard was the older gentleman of the captains, he was supposed to be the younger, you know, he's the one who will go on the fist fights and da-da-da. Although Riker never actually got into many fist fights like Kirk would.
He gets into the initial bouts. Okay. The actual duels you don't see Riker do, those are for Worf.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. Yeah.
You'll see him, he'll be the first one who reacts to this fist, but as far as like, you know, like, this is the classic fist fight, that's usually given to Worf and sometimes to Picard.
You know, and I think what you said about him not feeling he was a very good actor actually plays to his benefit with it, because the role he's playing is the, you know, first officer. Mm-hmm. He's not supposed to be the senior experienced leader. He's not supposed to be the top dog on the ship. So if he's a lesser experienced actor, it didn't feel, it plays perfectly to Picard and his more seasoned you know, style. And the two of them, you can see them kind of both grow in those roles, both on the show and just in their acting. I thought it was really good.
He was a good counter for Picard, just like Leonard Nimoy was a good counter for Kirk.
I had an interesting experience with this, because growing up, Riker drove me crazy. I really did not like him.
I'm right there with you. I thought it was boring when I was growing up.
I could not handle him. I thought he was stupid. I also thought, you know, as a young man, because I watched it when it was coming out, then I rewatched it on cable every time I got a chance to watch it. He was like what I did not like about men, just in general. His arrogance, the way he handled women, was so slimy. I was like, I hate you.
Now I know why you don't like Kirk.
Yeah. But then I watched it recently, and now I'm a lot older, right? I'm like, oh, he kind of makes sense. Yeah, yeah. Maybe the fact that I'm older and he was playing someone in my age bracket, it just makes more sense to me now. The way he handles himself is quite a bit more dignified than I saw as a young man. So I'm wondering sometimes, you know, of course, characters have, you know, how old you are can really change how you view art, you know? But rewatching it this time around, I was like, you don't suck nearly as much as I thought you did. But thank goodness you grew a beard, because you look dumb.
It's horrible with that beard. We all prefer Beard Riker, right?
Yeah. Beard Riker.
Yeah.
That was fun when he shaved it in the movie.
It was but then it was like, oh, now I remember why you had a beard. So let's hit through the rest of the cast real quick.
We just brought up Worf.
Yeah. Worf.
Sure.
A very interesting choice to have someone who was an enemy of the previous series actually be a crew member on the current series.
Because he's a Klingon.
Worf was I got it right.
I knew it. You got that one.
Right.
I love Worf. I think Worf is a really strong character, and I get why they... I think he was so strong, they realized they needed to bring him on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Well, there's if you look at the episodes, there's almost 20% of the episodes are about Worf, if not more.
I thought he was really weak at first. The first couple seasons.
Yeah.
When they kind of allowed him to move from whatever the hell he was doing to becoming the tactical officer, and head security officer, it's like he finally got to be within his role in the Federation and yet still have his role as like the Klingon warrior finally merged together very well. Mm-hmm. He became interesting then.
His Klingon warrior is like the best Klingon warrior. Like other Klingons are like Gowron and, well, Martok's pretty awesome, but like Gowron and his brother, like Klingons have this like brash arrogance with how they fight, and Worf is not like that. Like Worf is very honorable. He's
samurai.
He's very samurai. Yeah. Yes. That's a really great way to put it.
Also, to delve into your samurai thing, you first see him as a Ronin. He's wandering. He's majestic. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know where he is. He doesn't know where his soul is. Who to serve and how to serve. As we develop his character, he becomes very loyal to his bloodline, but very loyal. I think is exactly who his master is. And even when you see him leave the Federation to go get involved with the Klingon Civil War, you still know exactly where his heart is. It's established. You know, when you first meet him, he doesn't know. He's wandering. You know?
I will point out a lot of the episodes that involved a lot of Klingon ideas were written by Ron Moore, who became the Klingon guru for Star Trek Next Generation, who would later go on and write Battlestar Galactica.
ESG, yeah.
I do want to punt his son, Alexander.
Oh, God.
Like, I just want to line him up like a football and punt him as hard as I can.
It's just amazing how Worf can totally, like, he can be such a badass. And he has that, like, bob cut, that, like, little page boy haircut.
Yeah.
That's stupid. But you don't care, because he's such a badass. And you give him to his son, and you're like, oh, yeah, it's a really stupid haircut.
It's a dumb haircut.
Stupid.
He gets some interesting hairstyles in that show.
He does. Like, eventually, he gets like the kind of like dreaded out look going on towards the like final version of his kind of wavy and down. I'm like, get it, you look awesome.
Yeah.
So, Worf. Totally great. Who doesn't like Worf?
Who doesn't
like Worf? Who doesn't like
Worf? Do you know who Worf is?
Yeah, I do. And I always remember him as kind of funny.
Unintentionally, so
yeah, exactly.
He's like Buster Keaton funny.
Yeah, he was always. I'm trying to think of
or like Spock, like that kind of humor where it was dry and all.
Right.
He was very much like Sheldon was in the first few seasons of Big Bang Theory, where he didn't mean to be funny. His awkwardness with the people around him is what made him funny.
Right. Right. I remember him being slightly aware of that as well, not just like, oh, I did something humorous, but it was also like, oh. All right, that's not what you were talking about. We weren't on the same page.
Remember that when this came out, right, when Beauty and the Beast was being made over in Disney, and that Michael Dorn was, they were picking between, gosh, I can't think of the guy's name who did Beast, but it was between him and Michael Dorn.
Rob Perlman. Wasn't it him?
No, he was the Beauty and the Beast TV show guy.
That's what I thought you were talking
not
about.
The, not
no,
the
I
Disney
mean the Disney
movie.
Animated film.
Oh, okay.
And they picked the other actor to be Beast, and they let Michael Dorn go, and he picked up this instead. And how I met the other actor, I can't think of his name right now, but he's like, I really feel like I dropped the ball there. Like, I should have been auditioning for Worf, you know, because it was such a long-ranging, sustainable career, you know.
There, I saw an interview with Michael Dorn, and he talked about his initial audition and said that when he was in the audition room, like, a lot of people were, you know, playing Klingons up as like, I'm angry, like original series Klingons, and he just went in there with just no humor and was, like, dead serious. And, that, I mean, that's
Worf.
Robbie Benson.
Ah, yes, yeah.
Data. Played by Brent Spiner. It's a tough call between Data and Worf for me as far as favorite character. What do you guys feel about Data? I feel this is definitely one of the characters who gets much better. Because in the first season, I feel he does play Data with a little more emotion than Data should. What do you guys think about Data, who could easily be written off as a Spock copy?
I so disagree with the idea of him getting better.
Really?
I really do. Yeah, I really do. I think the more human he gets, the less powerful of a character he is.
Well, take away the Are you talking about the emotion chip?
No. Okay. I'm talking about the... Remember the movie where he became an inflatable cushion? Remember the movie where he became Peter Pan as he shot out the airlock? Like, they just, like, they made him their... They made Data the deus ex machina of Star Trek. And it drove me freaking bananas. Like, every time we needed something to be solved, Data was the utility belt of the show. You know, like, who's faster, stronger, smarter? Quick, get that guy. And in the beginning, they limited his use. And then they just... Because I have an overall theme here, don't I? About, like, I think we should take a look at how we limit... You know, limits are important. I'm not saying that the ideas around Data aren't well constructed, but flip my Riker view, where I wanted to punt Riker in the beginning, be kind of grew to love him. I loved Data as a kid. He was by far my favorite. He was like, oh, there, oh. And then knowing him as an actor now, knowing his musical theater career and how much I love that stuff, I'm like, yes, yes. But then watching the last two seasons of him as a character, just was like, I was like pulling my hair out.
Really?
Actually,
oh,
I grew to like him more throughout the series. And it, no, it's fine. Yeah. I think because I loved him so much, and I'm not, I went with it. It's one of those things where I was like, okay, I just bought it.
Sure.
I think it's one of those things where you can either just go with it or it just rubs you the wrong way.
Right.
Like me with Star Wars.
Yeah.
sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And because I liked him so much, I think that's one of the reasons why, and this is like a minor character, Dr. Pulaski, why I hated her so much. Mm. The minute that she called him Data instead of Data, I was like, oh, I can't stand her.
Nope.
Oh, no.
No, you're not going to be on this
you
much
and your,
longer.
You and your tight, permed hair, get out. I was so mad because she had offended my sensibilities because I liked that character so much. And even when I revisited those episodes later on, it still just rubbed me the wrong way because
sure.
I still had this affinity for the character.
Yeah.
There is a lot of... The fact that Data is an android, there's a lot of scenarios he can solve or help prevent. But I feel they never really abuse it. I feel they do play it out pretty... I don't know. I just feel that doesn't become the deus ex. I really don't
show
that.
In the movies,
I'm talking about just the TV show.
Especially when he became a director, he started like really glamorizing his character more so. He directed two of the TNG films. And he just like he's like I can do anything. So he shot himself out of an airlock like Peter Pan.
Yes,
he became an inflatable life raft.
Okay, but First Contact's good.
Yeah, it's so good. It's so good. And I'll watch Data go hand to hand against Borg any day of the week and be quite excited.
Oh God, yeah,
it.
I love
you
watching
know, like,
Data.
Yeah,
fight
I will. Sorry, we're not talking about movies, but I'll watch Patrick Stewart fire a Tommy gun with total rage face on against Borg all day long and be happy about that.
DJ, what do you think? What do you think over there?
Data was a character I really, really enjoyed, but I always try to step back and look at him as just another piece of technology because I think for a character that was supposed to be on this, you know, journey of becoming human or more human, they treated him way too human to begin with. You know, he had his own room where he... I mean, again, I realize he went through the Starfleet Academy and did all those things. But for somebody that, you know, again, he was supposed to be a walking, talking, you know, android. They never really were like... There were too many people that were way too comfortable with that.
Wasn't there a specific episode called Measure of a Man where they debate... whether Data is property or a person?
Yes.
I feel that addresses the exact concern you have with Data.
And my problem with that episode, for as much as I loved it, and it's probably in my top five.
It's a great episode.
That's a debate that in my, you know, trying to analyze the show, would have happened well before he actually ever attains a rank and is allowed to go into Starfleet wherever. I mean, it's a great, great episode, but just one of those things that they threw in like as an afterthought. Because they thought it'd make good writing and good TV, but that never would have happened.
Okay. I like you, Brent Spiner. Don't listen to these people. He's
I do especially,
listening.
Especially in Sunday in the Park with George. You were terrific.
Let's quickly go through the rest of the characters because I've still got so much to talk about and running out of time. Rounding out the cast, you have Lieutenant Commander Geordi LaForge.
Reading Rainbow.
Reading Rainbow.
See, maybe that's kind of it for me too. Like, maybe he's like... you know, Data, you roll with it. I roll with Geordi all the time because I love him from Reading Rainbow.
Like, that makes sense.
Anything you do, I don't care what it is, it'll be great. That's gonna be great. You can invent that hologram girl and fall in love with her, I'm fine with that.
How cool is it? I was so excited every time he took that visor off.
Oh, so cool.
Oh, because Geordi LaForge was blind.
Right,
and
the
white
eyes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. He can see, I mean, they show what he sees. He sees like electric was it electromagnetic fields, and he's weird.
Yeah.
Geordi's blind. He's in charge of your ship. I want to be at the interview where Captain Picard is like, so my.
So you can't see.
My
can
chief
you?
Engineer is blind.
Right.
What am I doing right now?
Then you also have the woman who probably every boy had a crush on. Dr. Beverly Crusher.
Everybody loves a redhead.
She had some baggage.
I don't think
right?
she's the one everyone had a crush on.
I agree with this gentleman. Mm. He's going to say who was the. It was
Deanna Troi. The boobs of the ship.
Oh, and the skirts. Mm.
She was. Did she have skirts? I remember her with the cast. She wore like a bodysuit.
Dr. Crusher has extensive dance training.
I do. I will say.
She does. She was a dancer in Europe for like
what
years.
I gotta say, I do love Beverly Crusher though. Yeah. Like the whole Crusher clan. I think. Me,
Biggs, Wesley?
You know what? Yeah, totally. I think, you know what? Not big bad. Improvement on Boxy from the original Battlestar. Having, like, just a kid that you can, like, identify as, like, your,
yeah.
Well, okay, we gotta go back.
Okay, but let's go back to the redhead. Let's go back to the redhead.
Let's go back to Beverly Crusher.
Yes, I love Beverly Crusher. One of my, probably my favorite episode of all is one that is all about her.
Warp Bubble one?
The Warp Bubble, yeah. Remember Me. I love that one. And yeah. I think that actually started me realizing I should be nice to redheads. Since they're all going to go extinct.
She also had
soon.
One of my
I need
least
to be nice
favorite
while they're still here.
One of my least favorite episodes was Crusher-centric. And that was the one, I forget the name of the episode, where she is possessed by her grandmother's ghost or something, and she gets all 50 Shades of Grey. I mean, it was weird, and it was awkward, and it was a horrible piece of writing.
It was terrible. It was a mistake.
But the one where her and Patrick Stewart are linked,
that was
like telepathically.
Yeah. That made me have like fear about like sleeping next to someone for the rest of my life. Like I hope I dream worthwhile things tonight. Oh no. So okay, going back to your redhead thing, I am a fan of redheads. My fiance is redhead. My first crush ever was Pippi Longstocking, and then Anne of Green Gables. Pippi Longstocking came to me in a dream when I was 9 years old. Told me that we had to break up. I cried for 2 weeks. So the moral of the story is, I don't think I ever identified her as a hot redhead. She seemed too much like a mom.
Like a mom.
Because I also, if I was gonna, you know, if I was unfortunately gonna compare myself to someone and be in the show, it'd have to be Wesley. And I hate him. But the fact of the matter is, like, there was the maternal thing going on, and that makes sense to me. Like, so you were in the mom category. Whereas Deanna was not the mom.
She's not a mom. Not even a MILF. There's nothing maternal about
Deanna Troi. She senses shit.
Mm-hmm. She knows things.
She senses things.
She senses.
Just senses.
That's why Patrick Stewart and they had nicknames for everybody on the show, and they'd always be like, "You're the one that senses shit, right?"
So Beverly Crusher, though, I think she's also, again, if you're going to pull out the craft card, I think she's the one who came with the most acting chops. So when you see scenes between her and Patrick Stewart, they make sense. They get pop, pop, pop,
that
pop,
makes
pop,
sense.
Pop. And then later on, they develop the wonderful dynamic of, should we ever? Maybe we should. Let's go for it. Let's not. That kind of tension between the two of them. And the comfortable, you know, I don't know if you guys have had the chance to ever go through a really long breakup, and then years later, you get back together again, and life's okay. And you're okay there. And you're actually happier with the choice that you made to not pursue that than you were if you had pursued it again or if you thought about going. So the fact that they're so comfortable in a nexus where most of us would be like, oh, I'm going to go now, you know?
Yeah.
It's great. It's great to watch them. Very mature acting.
That's what it is. It's very. There's a maturity to them that it doesn't, they're not disconnected from what's going on. They just seem like very, like she and Patrick Stewart, just very well-rounded people.
Yeah.
I don't think she reminded me of my mom specifically, but it definitely just got a mom vibe, and I just got I was comfortable around her.
Yeah.
I knew if she was there, it was like, okay, nothing's gonna go nuts. Sometimes there are characters that are dumb, and it just grates me, because I'm like, dude, come on, you're on a starship. There needs to be a modicum of, like, understanding of what's going on.
And they show her really broadly trained, too. Like, there's times where she's the commander. There's times where you see her fighting. There's times where she's inside the thing with a gadget fixing the thing about. You know, like, she does a lot of cool shit.
Which is yet another reason why when she was gone and they replaced her with Pulaski, another reason I couldn't stand that Pulaski woman.
Well, also, how did that girl get off MASH? Because she just seems like a character who belongs on MASH. Pulaski,
anything else you guys want to say about Dr. Crusher?
No, I'm good.
And you want to say Dr. Crusher?
What a great name, right? You know, like, what a great
Crusher.
Dr. Crusher.
Beverly Crusher.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. It's just,
Beverly.
It's just such
anytime
a
anytime Picard says Beverly, I'm like,
Beverly.
Beverly.
Nope.
That brings us to our last cast member, Deanna Troi, Betazoid, who can sense things.
Emotions. She's empathic,
yeah.
Maybe?
again, journey, the 7 years, right?
First she 3 years, better.
I'm with you. Actually, I'm kind of okay with it. First 3 or 4 years, even though she has a silly dialect going on, and then she gets weaker and weaker and weaker. I think as time goes on, the time she ends up hooked up with, spoiler alert, Worf, the lad, I'm like, I'm gonna have to kill you. Right? You're not gonna survive this season.
It's like your friend dating a girl you know is just not really good for her.
To reach over and just be like, problem solved. I broke her. You know.
So. Just not my favorite. I mean, if you're supposed to be like because I think she was supposed to be the sex pot of the show.
She was supposed to be built her as such.
Yes, and when your mom is more interesting than you, that's just that's a bad sign.
Yeah.
Back to moms. To moms again.
Wow. I think you actually could probably wax poetic a lot about the idea of the mother character, and you can go ahead and jump out of the ship being the mother. There's a lot of mother stuff we could talk about for this show.
That'll be part two.
Part two. Deanna, they never rounded her out. And that's where it was. Worf got rounded. Everybody got rounded. But they never really rounded her out.
They made an attempt. They made the attempt at one point where she was no longer in the cat suits and the skirts. It's gonna you're gonna be in uniform and you're gonna be addressed by your rank, even though your position is this. And it just never really worked for her. It never did.
And poor Marina Sirtis, right? Because she never really did too much more than I know.
She did a lot of voice acting.
She didn't age well.
But she, like, her voiceover career, she was on Disney's Gargoyles, which was a big hit. Half of Trek was on that show. She's done stuff.
Cool.
So that's the... Oh.
I know you want to move on from characters, but you guys give me, like, a 2-minute crash course in Will Wheaton? Because he's such a, like, I get Will Wheaton doses as him being Will Wheaton in the kinds of things that I watch now, and I don't know what to feel about him, but I know that I'm either supposed to really like him or just hate him.
Well, Will was Beverly Crusher's son.
Right,
I know that. So I think he started out, honestly, as like the de facto, like what Boxy was for BSG, where it was like, oh, we have a kid on here, just have a kid.
But you did have to back it up for 1 second, though, because the dynamic between Captain Picard and Beverly Crusher was that Picard's best friend, as they came up through the ranks, was Beverly Crusher's husband.
Yeah.
And Picard sent him on a mission where he got killed.
Yeah.
Okay. The two of them wind up working together on the Enterprise. And so Picard, who was this, you know, very stern commander figure, it's not that he didn't like Will Wheaton's character, Will Crusher. It's just that every time he looked at him, he saw his father in him. So it was this, like, I need to distance myself kind of a thing.
Oriented to totally embrace it, which is what he did later on.
Yes, you know, eventually he became a surrogate father to him and whatnot. But originally, it was a very difficult struggle for him to accept that he was even on his ship.
I have to call him Wesley. I keep just wanting to call him like Will. Yeah. So then Will did this. So then Will and the traveler.
But I kind of like it's a little bit more Will that I want to like understand.
Well, Wesley,
why.
Yeah, it's because I don't think he was great. He's not a great actor. No.
He gets better. His character gets better.
A lot better. A lot better. Yeah. When they came back from the episode where he got in that really severe, they were in that stunt flying at the academy.
Yeah.
After that was a huge turning point for him. It was, again, leaving the boy and becoming a man.
Yes.
But he was your typical child prodigy that was surrounded by people that were, you know, pretty much geniuses because you're on the flagship of your Federation and... He was just, you know, either troublesome and stuff he did accidentally caused problems, or he was, you know, hey, how come the little boy genius just solved our big problem that none of the scientists could figure out?
Or they hinted stuff like in the future he would, like, grow into something that would be more. So they would, like...
Going back to your Sequest, they're very similar. Jonathan Brandis' character in Sequest is the child prodigy, tech smart... Kind of maybe could be sexy. Well, he was sexy, but like Will's not very sexy. No. But it was
for that
it's the Jim
age.
Hawkins character, right? It's this highly adept, highly fast, like good at everything. Puts his hands on when he puts his mind to it, and also probably is a super genius.
Yeah, like he could. He had like he was beginning to put out theories about like time and space not being separate entities, and it was one of those things that was like hinted at, like all right, you know, if there was like a Next Generation Part Two. Then maybe he'd be like a really smart guy.
Okay. So his ability now to take the piss out of himself in that really does allow him to become the nerd advocate that he is. You know, he's not saying, he doesn't walk around saying, I was amazing. He's like, okay, so that was, we were doing that. and now I'm here, and this is fun, you know. So he's a huge advocate for nerds now, and that's what I really appreciate. You know, he is our age, and he's taken it to the forefront all over the place. Yeah. So
I'm gonna throw out some words. Wait till I've said everything, and then I'll respond. What do you guys want to chat about now that we've talked about the main crew? Q, Lore, Data's brother, the Borg, the Romulans, the Cardassians. Anything here that you really want to touch
like
on?
Like Kim, Chloe.
Are we gonna talk about our favorite episodes?
We'll get to favorite episodes.
Then, Cardassians, I'll mention that.
Okay. I would like to touch on at least Q.
Let's talk about
Q, who is great foible or Borg. Great.
Well, yeah, he's just a great character.
He's not on the show very much. He's in maybe 10 episodes at the most. He only appears a few times every season, played by John DeLance, who was in other things, and I can't think what they are.
I saw him on Night Court once.
Yeah.
He was on Breaking Bad. He was on Breaking Bad.
Oh, he was on Breaking Bad.
Yeah. Was he in Breaking Bad?
He was when the...
Kristen Ritter's dad.
Yeah, when the plane crashed.
Oh, okay. I know who he is now. All right. Thank you.
He plays this omniscient... He's essentially almost a god. Like, he can do anything, go anywhere. He's very racist. He's Puck. He's Puck almost. He's like a grown-up Puck almost.
Oh, that's nice. I never thought of it.
Yeah,
he's
like
Puck.
That's
really great.
My head went Puck like San Francisco Real
World. Me too.
No, don't. No,
Shakespeare Puck.
Shakespeare Puck, yes.
Put a joke into the pool.
And I mean, he's a great contrast to Picard's, like, serious, you know, da-da-da. And he's involved in one of my favorite episodes, which we'll talk about. He's such a weird character.
I think when sci-fi plays with gods, you always run risk of it not working, right? Star Trek V. But his god character, beating a dead horse here, the fact that Q Continuum kept putting the spurs to him, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's this race of Q, right? He's one of many, okay? And they're like up on Mount Zeus, right, hanging out. But he kept kind of messing things up. So they keep kicking him out and then bringing him back in and giving him assignments that are like the crap jobs of the galaxy, you know? And so the fact that though he is omnipotently powerful, someone has the reins over him, you know?
Yeah,
and I think that's really great.
I kind of feel like he's like a benign version of Loki.
Mm.
But not always so benign.
Not so benign.
Not always.
Not more benign. Because he's definitely not malevolent like...
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not.
Loki's a good comparison. He's a trickster god.
Trickster,
right?
Trickster.
So you can understand Q, though. They had this episode where they kind of took everyone into the way that the Q continuum, all of them are named Q. And they had this, their perception of reality was this old, rundown, like, town that they're like, sometimes I'm the guy hanging out by the bus stop. Sometimes I'm the stop sign. Sometimes I'm just the tumbleweed that goes blowing through. They knew everything, they could do anything, so they became bored with reality. And that's basically why he would show up and just kind of go, nah, I'm going to mess with you.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay.
It's a very strange character.
Dick. Yeah, what a dick.
That's very true.
They're on a spaceship. Let them do their thing.
You just expressed Captain Picard's point of view.
That's exactly how he...
Anytime
I think that's
Q
how the
shows
face
up,
palm meme
that is where
up.
The face... I think it is
really?
From a Q episode.
But there are times, though, that he would do things and he was just being a dick. But the lessons that the crew kind of got out of it were some of the best episodes they've ever written.
I'm surprised. I do feel it's kind of an injustice that Q was never at least in one of the movies. Like, he should have made an appearance. I mean,
I will say that for being... It's the same thing when you go to any kind of character that's supposed to be, like, immortal.
Yeah.
You know, people age.
Yeah.
Like, it'd be difficult to bring him back and have him be, like, Q.
Yeah.
That's why they killed off Data in the movies. Brent Spiner was like, I can only be him for so long.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for spoiling that for me.
Well, you already said you weren't going to watch it.
But on that note, on the Q note, you were talking about, like, gods in sci-fi, but a lot of the times that I see in fantasy or sci-fi in general about, like, the god character coming in is always, like, the adolescent god. Do you know, like, you were talking about Loki, and I read something that, like, Loki was essentially 17 years old, right? In the god years or whatever.
In god years? So he's kind of like that kind of a...
Right. He's like, he's literally just kind of upset at the world and his parents and, you know, is fighting back. And it kind of sounds like that's what Q was. I don't know if that's true at all.
He's definitely on the outs with the Q continuum. Like, there's even an episode where the continuum punishes him for interfering with the mortal realm. It's strange. There's been several instances where they've punished him. It's weird. I see a hand over there.
I think I'm like the naysayer of the group. I think Q's overused, man. I like in the movies because they have to solve this shit on their own. Like, you guys, they even do that a couple times. There's, I think, if I recall right, one or two episodes where they're like, Q, come help us. He's like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. You're going to have to figure this out.
But a lot of times the reason they were asking for his help is because he flung them into the trouble that they were in.
You were also a valid point there, sir.
Well, that does bring us to a good point where Q introduced the Enterprise crew to the Borg.
To the Borg.
Stop it, you dick.
Yes.
Come on.
He introduces
the
Federation to the Borg.
So they don't know what it is, and he just says, hey, think you're so great?
It's a nice episode because he's like, you shouldn't be out here. There's dangerous shit out here. And Picard's like, no, we're fine. And he's like, you want to see what's out here? And he flings them halfway across the galaxy, and they encounter the Borg. And he's like, there's things out here that you should be very scared of. And the Borg is one of them. What do you guys think about the Borg?
I love space zombies.
You should meet my friend Mark.
I love the Borg. I think they're great. I think it's another one that I think they realize were big fan favorites. Mm-hmm. So I mean, hence why there's a movie.
And they don't overuse them either. They're in maybe seven or eight episodes, but when they show up,
I think I know the Borg
really
from
real.
Voyager.
Shit gets real.
And they are.
Yeah,
Voyager,
I know the Borg.
Yeah.
I know the Voyager Borg more than I do the Next Generation Borg.
Cool.
I was talking to my fiance about this. What makes the Borg frightening is that they can adapt. And that's, I think, what makes them way scarier than Cybermen, which they oftentimes are compared to in the sci-fi world. And there's a comic series now where it's the Borg and Cybermen side by side in the TNG universe, which is kind of interesting. But the fact that the Borg, besides being like Third Reich, right, they believe they're the ultimate of the everything. The assimilation idea, not just excitement that too, but these guys will take your individual unique collect and then pull it into them, and they'll extract what they want from it and add it to them and become even more amazing. They see the potential for growth. That's frightening. A monster who knows I can evolve to be a bigger, better monster.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ability to adapt. Like, they can look around and like adjust to what needs to be done. You know, that's terrifying. Because if you're fighting a big monster, if you're fighting like those big space slugs and Avengers, they're like, well, okay, when the Hulk hits us, that's bad. Don't go anywhere near him. They know, they're just going to plow right back into him, you know, that kind of thing. So
yeah.
I love a monster that thinks. That's a great monster.
You know, one of the great things about the Borg was the show starts off and it's, look at the amazing new technology we have. We've got the holodeck where you can literally walk into a little broom closet, but it can be anything you want and you can do any story. And our technology is great. We can fix this. We can do that. And then that was the antithesis of that. This is what technology can do to you if it goes unchecked and unregulated.
Yeah.
It'll literally take over your life.
And I think you bring up a good point with comparing the anti-Borg being like those slugs that fly. Because typically when you have like an enemy or a villain, it's kind of like your opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it ends up being like, oh, we're going to have brute force versus like intelligence. But then like your arch nemesis ends up being the person that can use intelligence against you.
Who also has a very similar viewpoint. That you
yes.
do. You know what I'm saying? Like, you go back to Moriarty and Sherlock, you go back to,
or even Batman and Joker to another.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we're the flip sides of each other, you know? And that's something we enjoy whenever there's a really good bad guy, good guy matchup. It's not that they're dissimilar, it's that they're similar, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and like, two things I really want to say about the Borg is, one, it's not that it's like one specific villain. Like, the villain is the race, which is very, very interesting to me. And I feel like the Cylons just don't ever, like, I mean, the Cylons, I think, are a great threat for BSG, but they're just not frightening like the Borg
are.
Well,
they're frightening in a different way.
They are.
They're not grotesque.
They are not
grotesque. They're not grotesque, yeah.
And, I mean, the Borg did it. They took the character that most of us loved the most and turned him against everybody else in this horrific display of just, it's great.
At one point, the Borg, actually, they take Picard.
No.
Oh, it's a great two-parter. Brilliant two-parter.
They are not afraid of, and I don't know if this is okay for this podcast, they're not afraid of the incredible rape and torture analogies that they use. Like, when he comes back, he's not like, there's not like, oh, that was bad, right?
No.
It's years of sustained duress. you'll see in the next two seasons him carry that with him until they eventually deal with it. But even then, you'll see it in the films. You'll see it echo through him. It is his Vietnam. It is his
Captain Ahab.
It is his white whale, which they address directly in the film.
Cinematically, yeah. Even there were just little things that they did, like any time it was Picard pondering the Borg. It was just this split shadow in his face where you could still see that there was a part of him that was always going to have that, and that question of, like, am I really back to being me? Am I whole?
And they bring that up with an episode where they were, what's that?
They tried to relieve him with command at one point because he's going to fight the Borg again.
Oh, yes.
I was thinking of, what is it called? Counterpoint?
The Drumhead episode?
The Drumhead, where they put him on trial. They put him on trial because it starts off like an independent tribunal.
Yeah.
And then it kind of spirals out of control and ends up being kind of like a witch hunt. And when he's on, I don't think it's the best episode, but they do have a part where they put him on trial and they said, hey, so you're telling everyone else that, you know, they're fine. Let's look at you now, Picard. Are you all fine after your experience with the Borg? And he's like, just shut up.
They also, not only do they take him and make him part of their collective, he is somewhat, like, they take him because of his knowledge of Starfleet, so he's kind of indirectly responsible for the death of, like, 20 ships and their crews, because this last defense against Earth is the Borg are heading there. It's a really good two-parter. It's great.
Yeah, and if you've seen pictures of the Borg, I mean, also just the physical...
you go back to the Geiger influence, right? Like, you're talking about...
Oh, yeah.
It's this very much... They knew when they created these characters what they had to do was spin off of, you know, movies like Aliens and Predator and say, what can we do here? What is savage and horrific and stylish? You know, those are stylish monsters. Those are monsters that are intriguing. And they, of course, they carry that through and borderline flip it over to sexy. When you meet the Borg Queen, eventually, you know, like,
she's also creepy,
very creepy,
yeah.
You know,
by a creepy woman. She's creepy in everything I've ever
seen.
She's
so good.
So we talked about Q and we talked about the Borg. We're running a little long. Is there anything? I want to talk about specific episodes, but are there any villains that we haven't talked about? That
my
you
favorite
want
villain.
To shout out to
my absolute favorite villain, and it's a tiny one. Is the mud puddle that kills Tasha Yar. Because I feel it wasn't until that episode that I felt personally that there were any kind of stakes within the show.
That's a good point.
So Tasha Yar was she security?
She was security.
Security. And pretty much she just didn't want to be on the show anymore. And she didn't really do anything anyway. She just kind of sat up in the back, like, said, so I don't think she did anything.
How dare you?
She didn't. She had a little, like...
She led the attack team.
I never understood why she was head of security when you had a Klingon.
A Klingon.
Right
she's
there.
Been years... Working, she was like the Bajoran data. What's it called? She was like the beginning idea for Deep Space Nine's Bajoran character. She
Kira.
Was part of terrorist cells, and she was grew up in the rough, like, you know,
with
bad
gangs.
Guys.
But
Kira,
Kira and Ensign Ro, I think, would be like better versions. But anyway, they go to a planet, they meet a killer mud puddle, and it kills Tasha.
It was killer.
And I didn't feel like it actually, like, the show had stakes. It was one of those things where, you know, I felt like, you know, there wouldn't be conflict between characters, mm-hmm. and it would always go on to the next episode. So now, knowing that a character could die, I was like, oh.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with you on that part a lot. I think that they, no longer are we safe in that we can kill off a major character. I wish they would have kept with it. Because that's why I like BSG so much. Is because when you watch it, if you're not watching it in one lump sum, if you're watching when it came out, you had no guarantee that person that you love was going to survive the next episode.
True.
And it kept us really... If they killed off one character a season, I would have clapped my happy little hands.
There
and
was...
then you have Game of Thrones and you're like, no, stop it!
Game
stop
of Thrones.
It!
We'll talk about that later. There was discussion of not bringing Picard back from the Borg incident. There's a reason that is a cliffhanger.
Because
they had not settled in on his contract.
Interesting.
I can't imagine the show with
no,
Picard dying at that point.
Yeah.
I can't imagine it. My
yes.
Outcast, do you have any questions so far?
No. I mean, I... No.
Okay.
Lots, I
All
guess,
right.
but...
Well, I'll get back to you.
Okay.
One thing I did want to touch on. Any specific plots or episodes that you guys want to talk about? I have a list of my favorite episodes. I don't have a list of the episodes I think are the worst. But usually I like to start this with, you know, how is Next Generation at its best and how is it at its worst?
So, favorite episodes? Kinda?
Sure, and if you can answer that question.
Yes. Okay, it's at its best when you let Patrick Stewart do his job. It's at its worst when you bring in Lieutenant Barkley.
Oh.
Yeah. You know, it really, really shows when you have an underdeveloped actor doing bad work. And when you've got a great actor doing great work, my favorite episode is Chain of Command Part 2. Mm. Part 1's great too, but Part 2 really is like, oh, you wanna watch some acting? Here we go. And, there are four lights, that whole bit right there. It's a meme nowadays, but it's because it's stuck with us. Mm-hmm. And it's like, whoa, we have... Here goes back to raising the stakes. We raised the stakes by killing off an actor the first, second season, I think it was, Mud Puddle killed her. But also, like, we can do this on sci-fi. Because sci-fi was the throwaway TV. You know, it was Battlestar Galactica, the first, it was just popcorn. It's just fun. But now, we can do some serious work. So, and then, of course, all the more, the reverse of that, when you show actors who are certainly not prepared to be up in this race-staked venue, it really shows. So that's why Lieutenant Barkley should get kicked in the nuts.
Matt, same questions to you. When's it at its best and worst, and is there specific episodes or plot lines?
I think we've touched on the episodes that I love, like Best of Both Worlds, fantastic. Even the pilot, I think, is a strong pilot. Because pilots sometimes end up being kind of a, like, okay, it's half-assed, we get it, it's what got the thing green-lit. Now they'll kind of develop after that. I think it's a very strong pilot. I love the Warp Bubble, Remember Me. I love that because Beverly and I'm on first name basis with all these people.
Again, Beverly.
So Bev and JL, because it ends up being just them at the end before it's only just Beverly. She's pretty much in a Warp Bubble, which anyway, she's in like her own little universe, and then it slowly starts like gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and then everybody else that was in the world, no one has any memory of them because they don't exist and they never existed, and eventually gets smaller and smaller, and then it's just her and Picard, and then it's just her. And she has to escape before it just implodes on her. Mm-hmm. I think that's fantastic. My least favorite of any kind of show is always the flashback episode.
Thank you.
I hate it. I hate flashback episodes. They're always filler. I feel like it's like halfway through the first season when they want to try to get people for like shows like Lost or like Alias or things like that. They want to get people, you know, who weren't around in the fall.
Yeah.
So there's a clip episode that's Riker, I think, remembering all sorts of stuff. And
that
then,
episode resulted from a writer's strike.
A writer's strike. Yeah. So
it was clearly a filler. It was just like, hey, what are we doing this week?
They did Patrick Stewart too, where he was like younger and he had hair, and it was a bad episode.
And then,
you remember that one?
Are you talking about Tapestry?
Isn't that the one where he gets stabbed?
I'm going to disagree with you.
That one is so good.
That's probably my favorite episode ever done. And the reason I'll tell you why is because I actually took something from that episode and really was able to, you know, take that kind of lesson into the real world.
Nice.
Tapestry, the episode I'm talking about, Picard, when he was younger, was very Kirk-like, brash. You know, still very smart, but, you know, didn't care about anything, wanted the next adventure, winds up getting into a fist fight with these crazy aliens, and one of them stabs him through the heart. So now, fast forward 20 years later, his heart needs to have repair work done on it.
He has an artificial heart from the stabbing.
He has to go and have this thing replaced. And while he's literally on the operating table, he has a Q experience. And he's kind of, Picard's sitting there saying, you know, what did I do with my life? I wish I hadn't been so young and impulsive and brash. And so Q says, okay, well, let's show you what your life would have been like if you hadn't done this. And now it flashes back to the present time frame, except he's like a lowly lieutenant.
He doesn't just show him. Like, he gives him the chance to alter his past because Q has that power.
He's living his life now as someone that didn't take the risks and didn't do any of those impulsive things, and he's just this lowly little nobody that kind of does his work every day and nobody thinks twice about it. And when he realizes that those decisions that he made really are what made him the man that he is, he has to go back to that experience and get stabbed through the heart all over again to go back to his present in real life. And what, believe it or not, there was a time when the show was on and I saw that episode. My dad was going through a very similar moment. He was just like, I wish I had done things differently, whatever.
Wish I hadn't gotten stabbed in the heart.
Well, but not literally, but figuratively. Really? I wish I had done this. I wish I had finished this school instead of that school or made this decision with my career. And I kind of told him about that, you know, and I was a young kid, 14, 15 at the time. And it was years later that my dad was like, you know, you telling me that really made me realize that, yeah, maybe I made mistakes then, but that's brought me to who I am now.
How awesome is that?
Yeah, and that for that reason alone, that episode to me just stands out is one of those things where anytime I look back at my life and go, man, I wonder if I had done this differently, you can't second guess it. You're at where you're at because of what you've done, and it's more than likely better off for it.
Man, a community of nerds. Like, how great it is to sit here with people who, I mean, I don't know you from Adam, but to hear how that directly affected your life. And this is the thing about this show, it really did raise us. It was part of our, I don't know, our coming of age experience.
Yeah,
was this show.
People talk about TV being a babysitter. This isn't a bad babysitter
no,
at all.
No,
no,
no.
I saw an interview with Whoopi Goldberg had a small character named Guinan.
Loved her, by the way.
Yeah. She was actually talking to a bunch of fans, and there's one guy that stood up and said, "Hi, I just want to let you know that I believe he suffered from autism growing up, and he had a hard time connecting with anybody, but he happened to find the show, and it happened to be an episode with Whoopi Goldberg, and he connected with that character, and that was the only human being he could connect with because things just weren't firing correctly, and because of that, he ended up going to a convention and happened to make friends and is married and he credits that all from Whoopi Goldberg's character.
I saw an interview with Patrick Stewart, and he said he got a letter from a fan who said, "I'm a cop in Detroit, so I see really bad things, and when I am at the end of my day and I think there is no hope for humanity, I go home and put on an episode of Star Trek. Because it makes me realize that there is good things, and you know, good things can come from people and whatnot." And Patrick Stewart said, I think he said he kept the note that it's just this like heart reaching hand out to him. And he was just like, "Listen, you know, it's good to know that our work has done some good things and influenced scientists."
I took a class in college called The Philosophy of Star Trek, and it was a philosophy 101 class that taught basic philosophy principles based on not just Star Trek, but mostly Star Trek, because they do such an amazing job of teaching those basic principles that we all kind of, you know, learn in different ways and putting them in a setting that was like, I can see what they're talking about in my textbook in some kind of a practical application, even if it's fantasy.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I took a mythology class for Star Wars. I love when universities do that. That's great.
But I think it's so easy for people before this and around this time to just write off fantasy and sci-fi just being like a frivolous venture and not really having any value to it. And hearing stories like this, I think, is really just like...
Question.
Yeah.
Can you guys think of anything right now that has an overall message of hope the way that TNG did?
I can.
What do you got?
Battlestar, I would argue.
Battlestar?
The remake of Battlestar, I would argue, attempts to do that. It may not... Yeah, I would argue Battlestar, probably.
Okay. Anything else?
I could see that, yeah.
But think about that. That's 1 4-year foray to sci-fi. This came out in 1987.
True.
And 70.
It's 2014 right now. What else held this legacy?
Doctor Who might do this.
For some, but...
I just think it's interesting to think that this... I mean, there is nothing... There's really never been anything like TNG. Of course, even comparison it to Voyager and all the different
DS9,
but there really has nothing been everything like chemistry and creation. I think like this. I think it's really a golden age in many ways.
I think maybe not specifically of hope, but just of kind of like hearing a message that not everything is as bad as we make it out to be. I would think maybe The West Wing, in terms of not specifically about the politics in the show, but that there are people out there that maybe really do believe in the system beyond, that the everyday infighting was one of those shows. I think that would probably be the only other thing really that jumps out to me, like, a great piece of TV that really just makes you look at the world a little differently.
I could see that. It could be like the Earth version of Deep Space Nine. It's like the political.
That's interesting. I was just thinking about the stuff that's really popular right now. It's very dark. We're going through another gothic age right now, as a pop culture. But like we're dimming and darkening and sweating and bloody and everything, which is okay. But I think there's certain things that it's okay that they remain beautiful. I don't want to jump too far, but I like Superman, beautiful. I like Batman, dark. You know, I think there's still room to keep some things full of color and light. And I think TNG is oftentimes full of color and light, and that perhaps we should let that be okay sometimes, you know, and that maybe we could use something out there. I think that why the Avengers was so much fun is it was still bright and flashy and shiny compared to all the grim, grim darkness that we're going through right now.
Well, I think it's also just of its time. I mean, at the time, like, we were nearing the end of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. It was not as bad as people thought of it, like, you know, in, well, right when it started. Like, you know, there's no missile crisis going on where people were very, very upset and stuff like that. People were actually looking towards a positive future.
Yeah.
And I think since then, and I mean, we have to acknowledge 9/11,
yeah.
I mean, which directly influenced BSG.
Mm-hmm.
People are now looking to the future as maybe not being as
hopeful. Bright.
Like, there's still optimism, yeah. But it's not overreaching. Like, there might be some glimmers of light within darkness.
Well, you go back to the idea of frontier. You know, there's two ways of looking at the future. One is that we are up against a stacked deck. We are in many ways. You know, and I don't want to get too dogmatic about this, but there's a lot of good stuff going on into that. It's some pretty challenging stuff. But it was challenging for the pioneers too. You know what I'm saying? It was challenging for the age of exploration. I think one thing this talks about is that there are so many obstacles. Q brings in this incredibly dark force. But, you know, with a good leader at the helm, or with good ethical character in our heart, we can push forward, you know. So I guess I'm excited about the possibility of taking stories like this and finding that the hope that these guys inspired, and how can we manifest that in our lives going forward and into our art.
Is that something that you think, because actually everything, now that you bring that up, every major series that's getting accolades right now, everything that's actually lauded, has this darker perspective where it's, you know, Homeland.
Mm-hmm.
American Horror Story. Breaking Bad. These are all things where it's more like we're celebrating the anti-hero or just celebrating like just darkness. It's not like it's not an overly positive way of looking at things.
Yeah.
Do you think it may not be possible to do that right now?
It's darkness is selling, man.
I think it'll eventually jump back to.
We just need another economic boom. If we have another economic boom, then that's kind of, you know, the middle and lower middle class field, then maybe it'll be something where people will actually have their perspective turned around.
I think it needs to be off the air for a while, but I think Star Trek will come back to television eventually. I think it's such a strong idea, and it's just been so wildly successful, even at its worst, that I think it'll come back, but I think what you're speaking to in TV's current landscape, it doesn't fit. And it may, I don't know, it's weird. I think if there is like a new, there's a new brave new world of television of where it does celebrate the light, I could see Star Trek, the next generation or whatever that show is going to be called, will probably start it. I don't know, it's an interesting theory.
Yeah, I don't know that, again, this is maybe a little off our original topic, but not everything out there is so dark and gloomy right now.
It's not.
Some of it is really about actually, you know, taking that veil away and opening the light. Again, I don't know that I gravitate towards him specifically, but another Sorkin project in the newsroom is all about that. It's like, no, let's talk about all the darkness out there and push it away and make ourselves, you know, really open up to all the things that are still out there that can be worked on and things we can do. You know, there's always going to be times where the darkness is attractive. I mean, hell, look at, you know, there's so many things out there. You know, everything now is very noir. It's, we've got vampires and werewolves and sparkly vampires and all sorts of, and everything.
Walking Dead.
Yeah, there's that. But then that's another one of those shows that, for as dark as it is, The Walking Dead is perfect about there's always hope. Because while there's people together, there's always hope. It might be fleeting, but there's always hope.
We'll have a Walking Dead podcast then. Oh man, that show. So, this has been a great discussion, gentlemen. Is there two questions I want to take us out with? Does this show hold up? Obviously the aesthetics, the special effects, maybe not. But what about the show itself? I feel the storylines definitely do, particularly later seasons. Season 1 and 2 are a little rough, but what do you guys feel?
I think yes and no. I think some of the stuff that's centered specifically around the morals and the ethics definitely hold up. Some of the things that they tried to address about, you know, technology and the dangers of, you know, that, the technology that we actually have now, 20 years later, mm-hmm. is probably something that even these guys couldn't have thought of then, even though they were forecasting into the future.
Yeah.
So I think there's some things like that that, you know, they only ever briefly touched on some of those things. You know, the dangers of things like the holodeck and the addictive quality mm-hmm. that we have with those kind of things where you can really step away from fantasy or into fantasy away from reality. I think they would have needed to do a little bit more on that for the technology to hold up. But that's just me.
I feel it does hold up pretty well. My feeling about the way they showcase technology is it's never necessarily... I don't feel it feels dated in a way that a movie like, say, Jurassic Park feels a little dated. Or like the technology they have there. Or I just feel like it's almost like in a cross your fingers, Jen. But like with the Unix system and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like I feel like that you get gotcha, wah. But I feel like the way they kind of present it, it still has a slight fantasy twist to it.
Mm.
That it makes it just outside of the realm of possibility for me. That even when you see it, it doesn't necessarily feel like, oh, it's that tired trope again. No, like I know that's a makeup effect, but even the concept of the Borg. Which I know is just one of many things that they talk about in all the 100 and how many episodes? 78. one of many things, but it's still a great idea. It's still fantastic, and it still kind of like makes my mind sparkle. And now they're talking about sparkly vampires. Mm-hmm. Makes my mind just kind of like ignite in a way that like other stuff doesn't that's written kind of now.
I think that you touched on the technology thing. I just rewatched the whole thing from beginning to end, and I think what makes the tech stuff work is it is almost gobbledygook they're talking about. You know what I'm saying? Like metaphysic inducers and like what
their Trek babble.
You're not saying words.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, so what? Jurassic Park, which is like a CD-ROM. We're like, yeah. Okay, that's great. But the fact that a lot of their techno stuff really is still like, how does that work? It's a dilithium crystal. What's that? Oh, I don't know. Yeah, and then I used to get the Star Trek Insider magazine back when I was a kid, and they show the script, and it says, so Geordi says, and then when they leave, it says, tech, 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 tech. And then they have a tech person come in and put the tech dictionary words
that's
in
so
there,
funny.
Right? They don't even write the tech. They just know that somebody will fill that in for them later on. And so I think that's a really important gatekeeper for this TV show because it does help you get past the, like, wait a second, is that the plastic microchip? Is that like, what is that? How do I compare it to my life? Is that a jump drive? So you don't have to worry about that. It's still kind of the magical thing that does the what's it, you know? It's still kind of their science screwdriver.
I don't know. I just think there's a part of me that imagines if you were to take 2014 technology and write the show around it, you're going to have people walking down the hallways of the Starship Enterprise on their little pads, whether those are iPads or whatever, and they're still texting each other and they're still doing little things because we still get so caught up in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it amazes me that there was ever free time for the holodeck because that's the first place everybody would go.
See, yeah, why isn't everybody there? Second thing is that, like, you get the idea, and this is maybe me, like, reading way too much into it, that so all the gadgets came out and all the great, and then there was, like, there's like a step away from the technology. Like if you look at their quarters, it's always very sparse. Like they could have a lot more shiznit going on in there, which you'll see later on in BSG. There's like you know, there's lots of clutter, right? There's very little clutter in this world, in the Starfleet world. There's very little clutter, right? And the idea that we train these people to really hone in on their only identity is their job. You know what I'm saying? For the most part, even though they have characters who, you know, Picard loves archaeology and he's got the flute that he plays, right? Right? The flute, isn't it?
Yeah, Inner Light. We never talked about it.
Yeah.
Great episode. Go watch it.
But for the most part, you look at his quarters, there's very little in there. So I get the idea, and this is again me reading probably too much into it, that they went through like everybody's got the everything, but then they train your mind to put down the thing to be here, you know?
I feel like a reason that this show works so well and Battlestar Galactica, the newer one, why they work so well is the technology and the space-centric everything. That's just the MacGuffin. Like, it's just to get them places, and then it's really about something else.
Yeah.
Like, it's really, especially in the later seasons when they can actually go into character stuff or more like conflict, it's not really about the dilithium crystal. I think if they actually focused something and it was like front and center,
yeah,
then we would definitely, at least for me, I would be a lot more prone to be like, yeah, mm-mm.
Andrew, we've totally barreled over you. I apologize.
No.
You're smiling. That's good.
Yeah. No, I'll watch it all and let you all know if it stands up. Mm-hmm. I'll be the final arbiter on that.
We'll talk to you in like 3 months.
Guys, this is awesome. My mind is blown. I don't know what to do anymore.
Any final thoughts? We're running really long, so I've got to kind of wrap it up. Any quick little one sentence or things you want to say about Next Generation?
I just want to say this has been a blast. It's been really nice talking to you guys, and it's, I think the thing Will Wheaton said in some of his speeches, he say that the camaraderie of like-minded nerds is a beautiful, precious thing. And you know, growing up, I grew up in this tiny town, Northern Michigan. Mom, our population was 3,000. My graduating class was 40. You know, to come down and be in Chicago with people of a similar mentality, meeting around, talking about cool stuff, that's the best thing in the world. That's why I like podcasts like yours, because it makes us feel connected, and that there are people out there, and even ones where you and I, we've had some disagreements, but like, that's, and it makes it even more exciting to be challenged by people who you respect about your viewpoints. Sweet.
It's easy, yeah.
If you could just re-record what he said and put it in a voice filter or like a slightly different font, that's just what I'm going to say. This has been fantastic.
Yeah.
No, I love it. And the fact is, we're sitting here running long on time. We could probably spend this entire day talking about this show in particular without even touching base on the other shows and the other stuff in this universe or how it compares to the other universe. I mean, we could do it all day. And
there was a lot we didn't touch on, That's fine. That's fine. We can just all agree to be angry at Andrew. So.
You
outcast. No.
I didn't know about Will Wheaton.
You get one, Andrew. You get one.
You get one. Gentlemen, thank you for coming out. Is there anything you wish to plug or promote? Any other shows or podcasts?
Sure, yeah. Last time I hung out with you was doing McSith. Mm-hmm. We're looking at still trying to bring that to C2E2. We have interviews with that going on, so let people know if you've got friends up there that they want to bring our amazing Star Wars version of Macbeth to C2E2 is a goal of ours. But in the meantime, my production of Princess Bride, which is on stage, we'll be performing at Hamburger Mary, Valentine's Day weekend, two weekends after that. Swashbuckling monsters, lots of great storytelling. So if you want to come out and play with your inner nerd, we continue to be the place for that. So www.edgeoforion.com for details.
Andrew, Matt, DJ, do you guys have anything you wish to promote?
No, I'm getting a cat soon. That's going on in my life. Yeah, so no.
Okay. I have nothing to promote. Hey, everyone, why don't you just make sure you subscribe to the Nerd Outcast podcast?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Please. That one.
Yeah, if you like us, please rate us highly on iTunes. It shows it bumps us up in other people's search feeds, which would be really nice. DJ, did you have anything you wish to promote?
World peace.
Just
world peace.
Nice. I mean, that's okay.
Yeah.
You're into that.
If you are in the Chicago area, swing out to the Public House Theater. I'm around there. Hopefully going to be doing a show sooner or later. They do some good stuff. If you have any questions, comments, or protests, please email them to nerdoutcastpodcast@gmail.com. I also take topic suggestions. As I have learned from all of my experts. I have been your host, Chris Bashan, and talking with me on what may be the second longest podcast I've recorded about Star Trek The Next Generation are...
DJ Fink.
Matthew Amador.
Andrew Kudla.
Orion Cooley.
Make it so.